Hello, and welcome to Pod Emperor of Dune. I'm Elaine, a longtime sci-fi fantasy fan, reading Frank Herbert's classic science fiction Dune Saga for the very first time. I'm joined by my co-host Alex, who is tackling his first reread. Join our chapter-by-chapter deep dive into the series, as I make wildly incorrect predictions, Alex tries not to give anything away, and together, we learn to walk without rhythm.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Pod Emperor of Dune. I'm Alex, here as always with Elaine.
Hey, guys.
Today, we're going to get through chapters 45 through 48 of God Emperor of Dune.
Mm-hmm.
We're starting off with a chapter where we run into multiple characters. Nayla, Maneo, Duncan, and Siona. And then we get another classic Maneo Leto chapter, as we've seen many times.
Yeah, if by classic you mean Leto being an asshole, Maneo being scared and confused, then yes.
Yes, yep. Seems to be a trend. Then Duncan and Siona off with the Museum Fremen. And then finally, Leto, Maneo, and Malki, who we finally meet.
Yes, we finally encounter the mysterious Malki, and he is a character.
Yes.
Not long for this world.
We say hello and goodbye to Malki.
Very quickly, yes. All right, well, before we get there, let's start with our first chapter for the day.
Our first epigraph today is from The Stolen Journals. Given enough time for the generations to evolve, the predator produces particular survival adaptations in its prey, which, through the circular operation of feedback, produce changes in the predator, which again change the prey, etc., etc., etc. Many powerful forces do the same thing. You can count religions among such forces.
So biologically, what Leto's referring to here is what's known as the Red Queen effect, where in this example, the prey species evolves, let's say, better camouflage that allows members of that species who have this trait to evade the predators better. And so that trait takes over the population. Mm-hmm. But then the predators are in a bind because they can't see their prey species as easily. So the ones that perhaps have better eyesight and are able to pick out the camouflage against the background survive better, are able to get the prey, and then that trait kind of takes over the population. And then it just kind of sets off this back and forth where they're each kind of pressuring the other, in this case in terms of hiding from the predator versus being able to see their prey. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of examples of this. If anyone ever wants a fun, interesting one that I will not get into here, look into Muscovy ducks. But yeah, so a real biological phenomenon, and Leto, I guess, is making the comparison to the role of religion as a predator and humans as prey, I guess, and that religion changes people, and then as people change, they in turn change the religion or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's one way you can think of it. I sort of saw it as like, you know, sort of like the Cold War between religion and science to an extent, right? Science gets more advanced, things and religions get disproven, and then they sort of have to evolve the way they teach their religion or, you know, whatever in order to keep up.
Or ignore science.
Yeah, or ignore
in the
science
case of many religions.
Yeah, depends on the religion, right? But lots of religions have been, like, a lot more hardcore, like,
oh, yeah, there's right? definitely a distinction. I mean, I was taught evolution by a nun, so you can find that balance, but...
Yeah.
All right, well, I don't really see how this is at all relevant to the chapter at hand, so do you want to just dive in?
It's interesting to ponder, but beyond that, no real connection, so yes.
Yeah, I always get excited when there's, like, a biology-related thing, mm-hmm. given my background, but
and you're like,
that,
oh, this chapter is going to involve evolution, and then it doesn't.
And then it doesn't at all, no.
Unless we're talking about one boy's story evolving into a giant worm man.
But he's not even in this chapter.
Yeah.
And also, evolution happens on the population level, not the individual level. So Leto did not evolve into anything. Just a point of clarification.
A transform. Whatever. Anyway, let's get into the chapter.
Evolution doesn't work like Pokemon. All right, chapter itself. So we start with Nayla appearing in Maneo's workroom, communicating the message that Siona has survived her testing, and that Leto and Siona have returned to the Citadel. Before dismissing her, Maneo asks whether some mysterious matter which we discussed earlier has been arranged. But before leaving, Nayla asks in obvious discomfort if she really has to attend Leto's wedding, seeming to struggle saying the last word. So I wasn't sure at first, obviously, what secret matter they're referring to. By the end of the chapter, I think it's clear that this means arranging getting Duncan and Siona to Tuona Village and guarding them there until she goes to the wedding to, I guess, protect everyone with the laser gun. I don't know.
Could just be ceremonial in some way.
Yeah, I don't know why she has to do it, but Leto seems insistent. But at any rate, I wasn't sure at first why she seems so uncomfortable at the idea of the wedding, whether it was just she doesn't want to see her, like, god figure doing something so mortal, or some other, like, crisis of faith. But then later they discuss that the fish speakers in general are unhappy about the marriage, mm-hmm. and it might just be that.
Yeah, and Leto had alluded to that chapters before.
Yeah, right? It was brought up earlier. And, I mean, it makes sense. He has this whole, like, fancy ceremony with them of, like, you are my brides, and then he's like, actually, I'm gonna get really married to someone else.
Yeah.
So, like, I could see how that would maybe undermine some of the fanaticism in a way, or make it uncomfortable, at least for the fish speakers, particularly one who's so devoted as Nayla.
Right.
Either way, Maneo tells her that yes, she has to be there, as she has the honor of being the only person at the ceremony armed with a laser gun, and that Leto has commanded that it be her. So again, unclear why it, like, has to be Nayla, unless it's just that she is so fanatical that he thinks she's the only one he can, like, 100% trust with the laser gun. But, like, I would think that he has other trustworthy fish speakers, so I don't know why it has to be her. Unless he's just, like, opening himself up to Siona having the chance to kill him. Because this seems like he's asking for it. Like, he's telling Nayla, you have to do whatever Siona says no matter what. And, like, Siona could very easily be like, hey, Nayla, you're going to this wedding, you're gonna have a laser gun, shoot Leto. And she'd have to do it, like... Mm-hmm. I don't know. Unless that's the reason, I can't see why it has to be Nayla. Anyway, Nayla processes for a moment, cryptically says to herself that he is God and I am mortal, and then takes her leave. Maneo wonders for a brief moment what is bothering her, but he's unsurprisingly distracted by thoughts of his daughter instead. So, we don't really get much insight into Nayla's frame of mind here, but she's clearly, like, unhappy and disturbed. Maneo reflects on Siona surviving the test as he had once done, of now having a sense of the golden path. Because that's apparently what happens. Like, they can't see the future or anything, but they can, like, sense if the golden path is on track or something. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, like, vaguely described, and I don't know if, like, they get a tingling in their fingers, the golden path is in danger.
Spidey,
like,
senses, warm senses.
Yeah. Like, I don't really know what this means, but
yeah,
apparently that's what they get from this testing.
Just a gut feeling.
Presumably. But despite this new thing that they share, Maneo feels no added kinship with her. Instead, he considers that they both have the same burden of understanding, which would curb her rebellion, as it had all of the Atreides. Maneo believes that Leto has ensured that no Atreides can go against the Golden Path. Of course, we'll see if this holds true for Siona, because she really didn't seem on board at the end of her testing, but for now, she's at least playing along, it seems. Maneo thinks back to his own history as a rebel, of always being on the run. He considers that with the revelations of the testing, Siona has been caged, just as he once had been caged, and just as Leto himself had once been caged, once he glimpsed the bleak future of humanity and felt that he had to act to stop it. Maneo looks down at his table, and all of the work he still needs to do to prepare for Leto and Hui's wedding. He summons a young fish speaker acolyte to bring him water and to summon Duncan Idaho, and he notes the woman's long lute player's fingers. Going back to his work, he thinks about how his life has been long and his burdens endless. After a while, the acolyte returns to see if he will eat yet, and he defers for now, but asks her to leave the door open and practice her music so that he can hear. She smiles radiantly, and when she begins, he notes her talent and thinks that she could perhaps one day move up to the Balisette. Duncan enters a short while later, sitting down across from Maneo without invitation. He takes charge of the conversation immediately, challenging Maneo with a question he has been considering. What had his predecessor not learned? Maneo is taken aback, as this is a very un-Duncan-like question, and he momentarily wonders whether the Salaxu could have done something subtly different with this one. Maneo asks what has made Duncan think of this, and Duncan says that he has been thinking like a Fremen. Maneo points out that Duncan is not a Fremen, but he retorts that Stilgar himself had once said that Duncan was probably born Fremen without knowing it until coming to Dune, which I think should be taken as a compliment rather than a literal statement of Stilgar's belief.
Yeah. A little bit too much of a literal interpretation there, for sure.
I mean, I don't think Duncan is saying, like, I am a Fremen secretly, but it's just... It's an odd thing to say. Well, like, Stilgar once said I was a Fremen, so there, Mineo.
Stilgar was theorizing that I was kidnapped as a child.
Anyway, Duncan continues that thinking like a Fremen had made him recognize that you should never be in the company of those you don't want to die with. But he thinks Mineo may be one of those people, so he wonders what made Leto choose him as his closest confidant. Mineo replies that it is because he passed his test, and Duncan refers to the fact that Siona has also passed. Mineo seems a little bit disturbed by this, because it indicates that the fish speakers have been reporting things to Duncan, or possibly that Leto had even spoken to Duncan, but he thinks that it is almost impossible that he wouldn't have heard if this had happened. Mineo reveals to Duncan that his own test had been different, as apparently he had not been brought out into the desert, but instead left in a maze of caverns with nothing but some food and a vial of spice essence. Duncan asks what he had chosen, and Mineo says that if Duncan is tested, he'll learn. I don't really know what that test would entail. Like, it's not, like, a map. Uh-huh. Does the spice let him navigate out of the caves? I don't know. A little unclear. Maybe we'll learn more about that at a later date, but the point is it was a different test, so it's not always the same.
Yeah, good to know that, though. That was one of our questions when Siona was getting tested.
Mm-hmm. Duncan comments that there are aspects or parts of Leto that each of them is unaware of. Mineo agrees, saying it's because Leto is the loneliest person ever to have existed. Duncan tells him not to try to play on his sympathies, and Mineo warns him that Leto's moods become volatile and dangerous when there's any barrier to his plans, so Leto must not be obstructed, using the metaphor of a river. Looking at the window, at the one that bears his name, Duncan asks what Mineo knows about rivers. We learn that in his youth, Mineo had apparently traveled by boat on both river and sea in the service of Leto. Sailor Mineo. As he describes his experience, Mineo feels close to some revelation about Leto, and he recalls traveling by boat on some faraway planet years ago. He recalls a storm they had experienced, standing on the deck with the captain, fearing for his life as the waves crashed and the ship rose and fell on them. He believes that his revelation is that Leto is both storm and ship, the center of the turmoil, but also the only safe passage through it. Mineo says that he will help Duncan learn what the other Duncans had failed to do, telling Duncan that he has not learned how to trust. Duncan does not like this answer and acidly retorts that it seems more like he trusted too much, having put his faith in Leto and died for it so many times. But Mineo continues, saying that the issue is in the way Duncan trusts. He chooses male companions who will fight and die for whatever Duncan believes to be right, and he chooses female companions who support his masculine view of himself, and he allows no deviations from this pattern regardless of the good intent of people who don't fit this mold, apparently. Duncan doesn't get a chance to respond before Siona enters the chat, having been lurking in the doorway and eavesdropping for the last several minutes. Mineo's looking to see what changes have taken place in her, noting that she may have bathed and donned the uniform of a fishspeaker commander, but this cannot conceal her hollow cheeks and cracked lips and the veins standing out against her hands. Her eyes seem ancient and her expression is bitter. So she definitely has not physically recovered from the trauma of the desert quite yet. Almost dying of thirst would do that to a person, I imagine.
Yeah.
Duncan notes the uniform with surprise and some apparent skepticism. Mineo tries to placate his daughter, saying that he understands her bitterness as he once shared it. She seems disbelieving, and he pivots to saying that he is glad to see her alive. With acerbic sarcasm, she says how proud he must be to see her entering the God Emperor's service, having had a child so late but still getting to see her amount to something, Fish Speaker Command. Though she points out that as of now, she commands only one Fish Speaker, whom we later learn to be Nayla, unsurprisingly.
Mm-hmm.
So, it seems to be something of a ceremonial title for now. So she gets the uniform, but she's not actually commanding anyone. Except Nayla, who she's already basically been commanding this whole time. So, at least she got some fancy new clothes. Mineo suppresses his fatherly instincts and warns her coldly to sit down, but she says that she prefers to stand. She looks at Duncan, addressing him as her intended mate, and asking what he thinks of the fact that she commands only Nayla, until Leto eventually fits her into the command structure of the fish speakers. She asks whether Duncan knows Nayla, and when he nods, she comments that even she is unsure whether she actually knows Nayla. She asks Mineo, and he shrugs. She points out that he was speaking of trust before she entered, and asks whom he himself trusts. Duncan notes that Mineo is clearly suppressing some strong emotional response to Siona's needling, but he doesn't think that it's anger. Mineo replies that he trusts Leto, and he in fact needs to communicate the God Emperor's wishes to the two of them. Siona mocks the idea that Leto's commands are merely wishes, because obviously it's kind of just a euphemism for, like, these are his orders, and this is what you will do. Mm-hmm. For his part, Duncan tells him to go ahead, as he knows they don't really have a choice either way. Mineo says that they always have a choice, but Siona says not to listen to Mineo, because he's full of tricks, and that he and Leto are just trying to get them to breed more loyal Atreides servants like Mineo, who is both Siona's father and a previous Duncan's descendant, which, as we've discussed, is kind of weird.
Yeah. Hey, breed with my ancestor.
Or the clone of my ancestor, anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and your same, own ancestor.
Yeah, same DNA, though, so it's basically the same person.
I mean, I don't think that's true. Identical twins are not the same person.
I guess that's fair. But he still has, like, the same Duncan memories. I mean, it's Duncan,
it's more,
right?
Yeah, it's more of it. They've diverged since, but yes. Maybe the earlier Duncan was less of an asshole than this Duncan. I suppose we'll never know. Mineo gets frustrated and warns them that they are both fools, but he is trying to save them despite themselves. Duncan is strangely moved by the sincerity of emotion that he sees in Mineo's face and bids him to proceed, warning him that he won't be Leto's stud, but he'll listen to what Mineo has to say. Siona comments again that this is a mistake, and Duncan makes his own mistake of saying, "Be still, woman," causing Siona to glare at him and warn him that if he addresses her in such a way again, she'll wrap his neck around his ankles, which is an interesting thought.
Interesting mental image.
Yeah. Duncan starts to turn towards her in anger, but Mineo wearily warns him that she could probably do it, and bids him to remember what happened when he recently tried to physically challenge Mineo, who is like an old man compared to Siona being a young and fit woman. I can't imagine Duncan would come out on top of that fight either.
Yeah, probably not.
Considering how easily Mineo put him down.
Yeah, and that does get alluded to here, right? That, you know.
Yeah, he's like, remember what happened.
Yeah.
She could do this. Mineo kicked his ass. Down.
Mineo kicked his ass, and then, you know, if Siona's even stronger than Mineo, yeah.
Which you'd have to expect she would be, given that she's not old.
Yeah, and she's been, like, training as, like, a rebel fighter, right? So she's got some skills.
I mean, in the first part of the book, we saw her doing this, like, incredible feat of, like, out-sprinting wolves and swimming across a river. So, like, I think she's in good physical condition.
Mm-hmm. And Mineo's basically Leto's secretary at this point, so...
So if he can put down Duncan.
Yeah. Old man Mineo.
Anyway. An annoyed Duncan takes a deep breath to calm himself and tells Mineo to say what he has to say. Siona approves of this, saying that Mineo can talk, but they shouldn't commit to listening to him. Mineo finally proceeds, saying he is nearly done with preparations for the wedding. For now, that is. And that he wants them both out of the way for the event. Which is a little surprising in at least Siona's case, because I kind of thought that Leto wanted her there. Maybe not Duncan, because I could see Leto not wanting him there for the wedding to Hui, but I would have thought that he would want Siona at the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that this is Mineo's idea rather than orders from Leto, and he blows up at his daughter for her lack of sense of honor and duty, asking whether she's learned nothing from her time with Leto. She bitterly says that she learned the same thing that he did, and gave her word to Leto, which she'll keep. She says that she'll command the fish speakers whenever Leto trusts her with command, and points out that Leto is far more devious than her father. Duncan asks where Mineo wants to send them, with Siona interjecting the caveat of them agreeing to go. Although, I doubt they have a choice. It turns out that he wants to send them to a small museum Fremen village called Tuono, which he describes as relatively pleasant, with good food and a well. All you need.
Yeah, that's the definition of pleasant. It has a fucking well.
Siona counters by saying that there is, like, literally nothing to do there. And it's obviously a ploy to get them to give up and have sex out of boredom, I guess. Like, that's what I'm envisioning, is Mineo's like, I'm gonna send them to the most boring place I can come up with, and so they'll have to bone. Good food and a well. And then when we actually see the village later, like, it is a trash heap.
Yeah.
It's not pleasant. It's not a nice place. It's freaking terrible. For, like, a number of reasons.
This place sucks. The food isn't nearly as good as you said it was. The well's fucking terrible.
And there's nothing to do except watch fake Fremen cosplayers do rituals badly.
I have to either look at them or look at the shitty well.
But I'll do that rather than fuck Duncan.
Yeah.
Anyway. So yeah, I can't help but think this is just like a ploy to get Duncan to knock Siona up and give Leto more Atreides children. Particularly with her hiding trait. But Siona swears that she'd rather die than give him that. Duncan looks back at Mineo and asks what happens if they refuse. And Mineo just ominously says, I think you'll go. Siona elaborates on the boringness of Tuono, besides which the village of Tabor, in which Leto and Hui will be married, looks like a city, apparently, describing Tuono as full of mud huts. Duncan points out that the Fremen didn't live in mud huts, which, like, obviously, A, they lived in caves, B, you need water to make mud, and I don't think they had any to spare.
Nope.
And Siona basically shrugs and says, who cares where they actually performed their cultist rituals? Siona and Duncan snipe at each other before Duncan asks when they have to leave, which is apparently immediately, which is what Mineo had been talking to Nayla about earlier. There is already a troop of fish speakers under Nayla, who will escort them and serve them at Tuono, although Nayla will leave on the day of the wedding for her lasgun duties. Siona says that they accept, and Duncan snarls at her to speak only for herself. She then sarcastically apologizes and asks for the great honor of his company, as long as he keeps his hands off of her, and he tells her not to worry about where he'll put his hands. He then asks Mineo if he's asking from kindness in sending them to this exile, and Siona interjects that it is a question of whom Mineo trusts. Duncan asks if he will be forced to go with Siona, and Siona replies that if they don't both accept, they'll be carried off by the fish speakers anyway, quite uncomfortably. And you can see that this is true in Mineo's face, so Duncan really has no choice beyond what anyone has here. To die now or to die later, as Siona puts it. Duncan still stares at Mineo, asking him to satisfy his curiosity about his real intentions. Mineo replies that curiosity has kept many people alive, and that this is Mineo's goal, which he has never tried before, to actually keep Duncan alive. I mean, it sounds like many of them live an awful lot longer than this one, so he hasn't probably really had to try that much before.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the chapter. Anything you want to add here?
I like feisty old man Mineo. He's got lots of good old man energy.
Everyone's feisty. Like, Siona is just whipping daggers at everyone. Duncan's just prickly always. Mm-hmm. And Mineo is just like, I have made this decision and you will go or you will be carried off. Mm-hmm. Like,
you're all fools, but I'll keep you alive.
Exactly. He's like so sick of everyone's shit. Siona's sick of everyone's shit. Duncan's sick of everyone's shit. They're all sick of everybody. And so, yeah. If I was Duncan and Siona, I would not want to be sent off to this village. Like, to send them back to Aan or something, where there's, like, maybe some embassies to check out or, like, something to do, but
you'll obviously love it there. There's mud huts and a well.
Back in my day, that's all we needed to keep ourselves entertained.
It's like being sent to, like, live at the shittiest medieval fair ever, basically.
Yeah, so I don't envy them their destination. It's not much of a vacation, but that's where they're being sent.
Yep, and apparently
they may get company, as we'll learn in the next chapter.
Yep.
All right, so you want to epigraph us up?
Yes. So the next epigraph is... You want to guess where it's from?
Is it from the Stolen Journals?
Oh, shit. How did you know?
I'm psychic.
Yeah. Stolen Journals.
I have prescience, actually, and I can see the past, present, and future.
Ooh. Why do we do predictions, then, for this podcast?
Right, you'd think I'd be better at them.
How are you getting, like, 60s and 70s percentile? Or percentage. It required almost 1,000 years before the dust of Dune's old planet-wide desert left the atmosphere to be bound up in soil and water. The wind, called Sandblaster, has not been seen on Arrakis for some 2,500 years. 20 billion tons of dust could be carried suspended in the wind of just one of those storms. The sky often had a silvery look to them. Fremen said, "The desert is a surgeon cutting away at the skin to expose what's underneath. The planet and the people had layers. You could see them. My Sarir is but a weak echo of what was. I must be the Sandblaster today."
Yeah, so my takeaway is that Leto misses the skin-stripping sandstorms of Dune. And is, like, reminiscing nostalgically about them, and then is like, I must be the sandstorm. So, yeah, that's what I got.
Did you see any correlation between this and Mineo's little old man in the sea story from the in the last chapter, where he was, like, on the boat and there were storms?
I think he was a young man in the sea at that time.
Mineo's an old fart, so I just always think of him, you know, even his flashbacks.
He was just perpetually old.
Yeah.
Old baby Mineo.
He's basically Benjamin Button, but he started off as an old shit, and he's still an old shit.
He didn't age in reverse, he just stayed that way.
Yeah, he just stayed old.
Anyway, no, but I also kind of just, like, read this and was like, I don't feel like this is important and moved on, so.
Yeah.
I mean, mostly just like, why would you be nostalgic for this? I feel like the planet is better off without storms full of sand that could cut people to ribbons.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's just him saying that he's going to be, like, a large impact and, I don't know.
Cutting away the gangrene of humanity or some shit like that.
Yeah, perhaps. I don't think there's really too much more to read into it than that.
No. Let's dive in. So, in this chapter, we have Mineo and Leto having a bit of a debrief, in which Leto was surprised at Mineo's independence and sending Duncan and Siona to Tuono Village. I'm going to preface the rest of this by saying that Leto was in full asshole mode during this meeting, having already started this off by making Mineo wait until almost midnight before seeing him. So he had, apparently Mineo had just been, like, waiting outside, and at some point, eventually, Leto was like, okay, you can come in now, I guess. And so, as a result, Mineo is, like, falling asleep on his feet because he's exhausted, because he's giving this report at midnight instead of whatever time he, like, went to go see Leto. So, the Majordomo is trying to hide any sign of trembling from the God Emperor, and asks whether he has offended Leto. Leto says that instead he is amused, but these days he cannot tell the funny from the sad, so don't be comforted. Mineo whispers for forgiveness, and Leto expresses frustration that Mineo must always seek external validation and judgment, never content to simply exist. Perhaps it's because Mineo is, like, deathly afraid that Leto's gonna flip out and smush him with his sandworm tail. That could be part of it.
Could be related. Yeah, possible.
Mineo recalls his earlier thought that Leto is both ship and storm, and he feels that he is at the edge of an important but terrifying revelation. He asks what Leto wants of him, and Leto tells him that he wishes that Mineo would have faith in himself. Again, might be easier if he wasn't constantly afraid of doing something wrong and being smushed as a result. A very anxious Mineo starts to ask about not having consulted Leto about the Tuono thing, but Leto interrupts him to say that those who seek power over others destroy the faith that people might have in themselves. Mineo feels overwhelmed, with Leto's tone seeming both accusatory and confessional, and he feels his grasp on whatever his revelation is slipping away. So it's like a weird thing where it almost sounds like Leto is criticizing himself for seeking power over Mineo and therefore destroying the faith that Mineo has in himself. But he also sounds very, like, accusatory towards Mineo. And so I think Mineo is just like, ah! And then whatever he was thinking about before is just gone. The poor man. Mineo asks for Leto's thoughts, desperate to claw this revelation back. But Leto angrily just tells him that, my thoughts vanish on contact, which is not helpful. He stares down at Mineo, completely distracted by the thought of Malky's imminent arrival on Arrakis. Poor Mineo is bereft, having lost the thing he was so close to, and he puts his hands over his mouth. Leto asks why he tries to stop the flow of time. Mineo pulls himself together and tries to get back to business. He asks whether Leto wants to hear about wedding preparations, but Leto just wants to hear about Hui, who is being prepared by the fish speakers and has approved the wedding arrangements, although she makes a rather cutting observation about Mineo in the process. Leto wants to know whether Hui has noted the unrest among the fish speakers, as we discussed, the idea of Leto's marriage disturbs them, as Leto has mentioned before. Apparently, this unrest is part of why Mineo had sent Duncan away. So, Duncan tends to, like, rile up the fish speakers, and so the less unrest there is among them, the better, in this current scenario. And Leto notes that Siona has been sent with Duncan, I think with the implication that they will hopefully get together. I don't know if that will work out or not. Because the thing is, they seem to hate each other. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell if it's going to be, like, they actually hate each other, or one of those weird, like, they hate each other so much that they start banging. Because I could also see that happening. Hate sex.
Yeah, possibly. Wouldn't put it past Frank Herbert.
Yeah. If it happens, I just hope, for Siona's sake, that she uses protection. She'd be like, guess what, Leto? We fucked, but I'm not having a baby. Leto confirms to Mineo that she did pass her test and can now sense the golden path as well as he does, but Mineo is not reassured, still fearing his daughter for some reason. Leto indicates that this is because Mineo is ruled by reason, and apparently can see the danger even though he doesn't consciously know why or something like that. Leto has a weird and kind of disturbing thought about how easy it is to play with Mineo's emotions, which is, like, definitely a normal, not psychopath thing to think.
Yeah.
And also how close to the edge the man walks sometimes. And I'm not sure if he means, like, suicide or insanity, but, like, maybe you should not push Mineo up to this edge. perhaps. Just a suggestion. Let the poor man just be. The God Emperor replies to Mineo cryptically as usual, speaking of spectra and colors, and poor Mineo exclaims that he doesn't understand Leto, who recalls the many, many times he has heard those very words from so many people. And yet he hasn't changed his ways to not be a cryptic jerk all the time. He's like, oh, people always are saying how they don't understand me. Must be a them problem.
Yeah, you'd think by now might figure that out.
I'm sure he knows, but he just doesn't care. But it's just like...
fair, I guess.
It's just like, well, this is an obvious outcome of the way you choose to be. This is entirely in your control. You could just speak plainly, like, occasionally. He does sort of explain that by a spectrum of colors he means the golden path, but the rest of the metaphor, like, still is not very clear to poor Mineo. Mineo points out that Leto can see things the rest of humanity cannot, and Leto retorts that this is because they refuse to. Mineo tries to explain that Leto has moved beyond humanity, and that is why they worship him, but Leto interrupts him with a curse, terrifying his poor majordomo. I swear Mineo's just gonna have a stress heart attack at one of these points. In one of these meetings. Leto rants about civilizations and religions and is frustrated at Mineo not understanding things the way that Hui does. Mineo points out that she's Ixion, and Leto retorts that she's a fish speaker, having been created from birth to serve him. And he stops Mineo from interjecting, presumably to say what? He continues that the fish speakers are upset because they have spent their whole lives training and were named as Leto's brides, but Hui sweeps in from outside and is better at it than they are, or something like that. Mineo is confused by this theory. How surprising. And Leto rants about how everyone is born knowing who they are and what they're supposed to do, but adults confuse children who then forget this knowledge that they had, or something. He then demands that Mineo recall this knowledge of who he is supposed to be that he apparently forgot as a child. Poor Mineo cries out that he cannot because he does not have Leto's powers or knowledge. Leto interrupts Mineo's hysterical rambling, speaking in soothing tones, saying that he can see Mineo's fatigue and recognizes that he has asked too much of the man. And Mineo slowly calms down, gasping for air a bit. Leto then lets him know that he would like to use the water rings of Chaney rather than of Ganema in the wedding ceremony, pointing out her tomb down the hallway of the crypt that they stand in. Mineo is appalled at the idea of desecrating Chaney's grave, but Leto speaks in her voice, saying that she can do whatever she wants with her own water rings. So, I mean, I guess that's, like, a card you can always pull out of your pocket. Mineo agrees, despite his misgivings. He doesn't like the crypts, and I can't imagine he's gonna really enjoy digging into someone's, like, ashes or whatever. Her bones. I guess Chaney would have been, like, desiccated, probably, right, for her water. So she's probably just, like, essentially a mummy. Like, a really dried-out mummy.
I guess so.
Although by now, I don't know, if they don't embalm them, she's probably just dust. I don't know. Kind of interested to think about what the Fremen do with the bodies after they drain all the water out of them.
Yeah, I mean, she was royalty, but, I mean, they treated everyone in the tribe the same, right, regardless, so I don't know.
Yeah, but Paul might have organized some special thing, because he didn't go out into the desert for, like, a little while after that whole incident.
Oh, that's true. Well, I guess it would have been Aaliyah organizing whatever Chaney's funeral would have been, right?
I don't know. Well, I mean, because Paul didn't, like, immediately walk into the desert. Like, I don't know if he stuck around for, like, a week before.
Oh, no, my impression was that event happened right after Chaney died. Like, Chaney died, and then he immediately walked into the desert.
Because we don't see it. We just hear, like, we skip to Duncan talking about it. But I thought there was the impression that, like, a day or two had passed. But maybe it was immediate. I don't know. But, yeah, I think someone would have dealt with Chaney's funeral and potentially in a way that wasn't just, like, standard Fremen. I don't know. But obviously, her body is still here somewhere in some form. I'm just kind of curious what it would look like after 3,000 years based on Fremen burial rites. Regardless... Mineo agrees to get the water rings and then says that he will bring the rings to Tabor Village for the ceremony. But then, because Leto is above all the worst, he says, as if he's commenting on the weather and not throwing the biggest wrench into all of Mineo's planning, says, Tabor Village? But I have changed my mind. We will be wed at Tuono Village. And, like, I'm just staring at the page, like, are you fucking kidding me?
What a lumbering thunder douche. Fucking, like, Leto.
First of all, the whole reason that Mineo sent Duncan and Siona to this place was to get them out of the way for the wedding.
Yeah.
So there's that, where Leto is not only like, oh, bring them back, I want them at my wedding, he, like, does this in the most passive-aggressive way of, like, we're gonna have the wedding at the place where you sent them to get them out of the way, so there. And then also, poor Mineo has spent all this time planning it at being in one place, and is just very haphazardly later, it's just like, oh, actually, I wanted this totally other place, make the arrangements. So,
yeah.
Leto is just the fucking worst. Uh-huh. He's so mean to Mineo in, like, this whole chapter.
You know, poor Mineo.
And, like, Mineo is just, like, you know, he was this righteous rebel who was trying, he was like his daughter who thought that Leto's tyranny was evil and terrible and was trying to rebel against it. And then was basically traumatized into serving Leto and continues to be traumatized to this day. And it kind of shielded himself from what he does by hiding behind duty and loyalty and all of that. But, like, he's a righteous but deeply broken man, and Leto just treats him like garbage all the time. And I just feel very bad for the man.
I know, right?
Like, he's not a hero or anything of the novel, but, like, I find him a very sympathetic character.
Mm-hmm.
I feel bad for him.
Yeah. No, he definitely is sympathetic.
Anything else you want to talk about in this chapter?
No, I don't think so. I think we can move on to the next one.
Sounds good.
All right, so our next epigraph is once again from the Stolen Journals. Most civilization is based on cowardice. It's so easy to civilize by teaching cowardice. You water down the standards which would lead to bravery. You restrain the will. You regulate the appetites. You fence in the horizons. You make a law for every movement. You deny the existence of chaos. You teach even the children to breathe slowly. You tame.
I mean, this just seems like kind of moral panic, sort of, about excessive laws and bureaucracy, which, mm-hmm. like, there's a grain of truth to, and certainly you can have autocratic society that suppress freedoms, but, like, A, Leto's doing that himself, and B, like, realistically, it can't last that long, like,
mm-hmm.
to the level that he's describing. Like, certainly you can, like, suppress freedom of the press, or, like, in the modern era, social media, things like that. We certainly have examples of that, but, like, they're like, oh, you can't take a step without there being a law for it, or, like, about the way people breathe. It's Leto's standard
exaggeration.
Freaking out about extremes yeah. that, like, aren't realistic or likely to happen.
No, I think it's, like, this is, like, one of those epigraphs that, yeah, he's exaggerating a little bit, but, I mean, there's some truth to what he's talking about. Like, you said examples, right? Like, China, North Korea. Like, there's countries that have a lot of control over their populace, and they've done that by having, you know, a one-party system that will end up suppressing the media, so there's no, like, voice of dissent at all, right?
Yeah, I think I just get frustrated sometimes with his literary tendency towards exaggeration to an extreme. Like, it's definitely a legitimate concern, but just the way he describes it, I understand it's, like, a literary device, but I find it annoying that he does it so frequently.
Mm-hmm. We're also looking at that through the lens of what we know in today's society, but, I mean, he could be looking at it through, you know, thousands of years of other things that happened, so I guess you can kind of, like, give him a little bit of a break there, but yeah, I still understand your point.
However, I will say that it is, for once, somewhat relevant to the chapter, I feel, in the complete and utter oppression of the society of Tuonda Village that we are about to encounter.
Mm-hmm.
In which, perhaps it's not through over-prescription of laws, but it is certainly preventing these people from making any decisions or choosing their own lives.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I'm, like, appalled by this chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we'll get into it, but I found this such an upsetting chapter.
All right, well, let's dive right in and find out why you're so upset, then.
Sure. So, Duncan can't believe his eyes when he arrives with Siona and their fishbeaker guard into Tuonda Village, unable to comprehend that this pathetic place is what the Fremen have been reduced to. Nayla had explained to them, upon arriving outside the high walls of the village, that the Museum Fremen are kept uncontaminated by off-planet technology, meaning that on top of all the other terrible things he has done, Leto has forced generations of these people into lifelong and pointless poverty, all because he wants them to cosplay Fremen life for them. Which they're not even good at. Like, he comments and complains all the time about how they're shit at what they're supposed to be doing. Like, as noted multiple times before, the Museum Fremen are actually pretty terrible exemplars of Fremen culture, which means that Leto is putting them through this absurdity for really no reason
mm-hmm.
beyond, like, his own, I don't know, ego? Like, I still don't really understand what he's gaining from their existence. So he's just, like, forcing them into generational poverty and shittiness for his own amusement.
I mean, is it his choice or is it their choice? Like, are they trying
to continue? It's absolutely not their choice.
No, but I mean, like, the continuing of the traditions and such. Is that, like, something he's forcing on them, or is that something that, like, they're trying to do to stay connected to, like, their ancestors?
I'm fairly certain they don't have a choice. It's essentially like they're trapped in a reenactment village. Because they petition him to, like, do other shit, and he's like, no, you have to keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, but, I mean, there does seem to be at least somewhat of a sense of pride from, like, Garun, who's, like, the Fremen leader.
They don't have a choice.
There. Yeah, but
he
seems to...
They can take pride in what they do or be more miserable. They don't have an option to do anything else. Well, they can't leave. They can't do anything beyond what this little thing that Leto allows. They can't have outside technology. They can't leave. They can't do anything.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with that, but I think... I don't think that they have a desire to all just leave and join, you know, the main society and just leave behind all the Fremen stuff. I think they're trying to, like, maintain their traditions to an extent.
I just don't know that they would if they had any choice in the matter. Like, the point is that they can't make another decision, so why would they even strongly consider it? Like, they can't leave. So, like, if everyone had the choice... Like, they don't have, like, an Amish from Springa. Like, certainly many of the Amish come back to their society because it's what they know. These people don't have that option. We don't know how many of them would want to leave.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't get the sense that they're, like, desperate to leave this society.
I mean, I think the fact that they routinely, to the point of annoying Leto, petition for changes indicates that they want changes. And that
I don't disagree with that. I'm sure it's reasonable that they want changes and that they definitely do want changes, but... I don't see them as, like, clamoring to escape from this village. This doesn't seem to be the situation.
Why clamor if there's no hope?
I mean, I don't think that's relevant. I think they're just not, like, trying to get out of this. Like I said before, I think they're trying to, like, continue their traditions, and that's, like, their primary focus. We also only really meet Garun, and we don't really get perspective from others, but at least from what we understand from him, that just seems to be the perspective.
Yeah, but he's also the one who's been, like, elected or whatever leader, so he's gonna be, like, the most into it, right?
I don't know. It's possible. Who knows?
I just think that the concept that you have this group of people in this situation at all is horrible, especially when we
read the conditions of the village.
Like,
yeah.
I just think their existence is fucked. Like, if there was a group of people who wanted to maintain these traditions of their own volition, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what's happening here.
Yeah.
Whether or not they are interested in preserving the traditions is ancillary to the fact that they don't have a choice about it either way. Anyway, Duncan walks beside a bitter Siona, who is staring intently at Nayla's back. Duncan can't quite figure out what the relationship between them is. He does see that Nayla is slavishly devoted to Siona and does anything she says, unless it countermands the orders to bring them here. They arrive in the village proper, which is a collection of decaying huts, which have been covered in shiny rocks and metal scraps in a sad attempt to decorate. It smells of trash and human waste. So yeah, these people are living in objectively terrible conditions and for no apparent reason, because it's not like this village is representative of what Fremen lifestyle was. Like, it's not like these huts and this decoration and the, like, smell of human waste is, like, accurate to Fremen culture anyway. So mm-hmm. There's no reason I can see that they have to live in such shitty conditions, other than that Leto permits or ensures that.
Yeah, it's strange. I think it's maybe, like, the only way you could even come close to replicating the way they lived in the past, because I think the problem is... You theoretically could have carved out an area like the Sarir and just threw them there, right? And they could have basically lived as Fremen, but there's no worms, right? There's no melange. So how do you can't. You can't replicate what they had in the past.
You could at least give them a cave network to live in, like a siege. Like, I don't know why they live in these, like, shitty falling apart huts.
Yeah, I mean, you Leto could have, like, had a cave network built for them or something like that. I mean, the hut thing just doesn't really make any sense.
Like, just because the desert has shrunk doesn't mean those caves aren't still there. Right?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. I just don't understand why they're living like this. It's just, like, needlessly poor. So in this sad, decaying village, a delegation waits to greet the newcomers. All are men in apparently authentic Fremen robes, and one man, the so-called Naib, wears a green headband. Children cluster to one side, holding flowers for the guests, while women in black hoods lurk in the back streets, watching from a distance. Duncan is distinctly unsettled by the entire scene. Because, to him, like, this is not what Fremen are like. In addition to the creepiness of, like, people lurking in back alleys and the general, like, poor conditions of the whole place.
Mm-hmm.
Nayla leads the group to meet the Museum Fremen leaders. The one with the headband introduces himself as the Naib Garun, and Duncan is disgusted to note that he has normal brown eyes with no trace of spice blue. I mean, I think this should not be surprising. No one should have spice blue eyes because there's just not enough spice. But I think for Duncan specifically, he's like, it's not right for a so-called Fremen specifically to not have the blue eyes.
His memory of the Fremen that he knew is driving his expectations. So,
but yeah, to a kind of ridiculous degree in this chapter, as we'll get to momentarily. But the eyes definitely bother him. Garun confirms to the group that quarters have been prepared and they are ready to extend their hospitality. The children run forward and press their sad, wilted flowers into the hand of the newcomers, one of which makes Nayla sneeze, which was an amusing detail.
Yeah.
But, like, the point is that they can't even get, like, nice flowers. Like, the flowers are all, like, drooping and wilted.
Mm-hmm.
So I really have to disagree with Mineo's characterization of this village as pleasant because of its, like, well and okay food.
Yeah, no, it's definitely not pleasant.
Garun asks Siona whether she wants to see a performance of Fremen rituals, music, or dance. Siona does not answer immediately, as a child tries to give her flowers, which she takes without looking. Duncan doesn't accept any of the flowers and just tries to wave the children away. Garun tells him that if he gives the children some money, they won't bother the group, and Duncan is appalled at the idea of Fremen children being taught to beg. Garun goes over the layout of the village with Siona and Nayla, while Duncan starts to wander off, observing the town and getting increasingly incensed at the decay and sadness inherent in the place. He pities these people, who cannot be called Fremen in any meaningful sense. Charged with trying to preserve a history they neither really know nor understand, memorizing and poorly pronouncing ancient rituals while having barely enough to survive, he can't fathom why Leto has created such a place. And I really don't think we have an answer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand what the point of this place is. It's not like a Gettysburg where it's, like, even, like, a halfway accurate representation. Like, the most accurate thing they're doing is maybe the rituals. But as is described here, like, they don't even know what they mean, and they're not even pronouncing the words right. They're kind of just doing it by sound without actually understanding any of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, what's the point?
I don't know.
I don't understand, like, what Leto is trying to preserve here, because whatever it is, he's doing a fucking bad job at it.
Yeah, true.
Like, I just feel like if you really wanted to have, like, a Museum Fremen village, you could maintain it better such that it was actually an accurate representation. I don't see what purpose these people serve. Duncan goes back to the main group, and he bends over to look at Garun's robe, critically noting that it has been woven too tightly for real freedom of movement, and that the man has allowed sunlight to touch his stillsuit in a way that no true Fremen would, presumably because it would degrade the material over time and they're too precious. Duncan is so incensed that he apparently loses all sense of propriety and rips open Garun's robe, like, just in the middle of this delegation, to look more closely at his stillsuit, discovering that it isn't even a real stillsuit, as it doesn't have any arms or boot pumps. Garun is understandably offended that this guy just, like, ripped open his clothes, reaching for his belt knife and telling Duncan that no one is allowed to touch a Fremen like that. Duncan derisively tells him that he is no Fremen, that he knows and fought and died beside real Fremen, but Garun and his ilk are nothing but frauds. Garun is livid and demands to know who the hell this angry man yelling at him is, because from his perspective, this dude just, like, rolled up and starts, like, ripping his clothes apart and yelling at him for no reason. And then is like, I knew real Fremen. This guy's like, the fuck? Nayla informs Garun that this is Duncan Idaho, and suddenly intrigued Garun looks closer, as apparently none of the Golas have come to their village in any recent history. I'm sure most of them have no desire to see this, like, pathetic remnant. Or maybe Leto generally prevents them from going there because he knows how they'd react. Duncan has a strong desire to cleanse this place even if it kills him, so disgusted is he by the whole town. He challenges Garun to either draw the knife for real or remove his hand from the hilt, which Garun does, confessing that it isn't even a real knife. With a sad eagerness in his voice, he explains that they do have real knives, even Chris knives, which are kept locked in display cases for preservation. Duncan can't help but laugh at this, while Siona smiles and Nayla just watches. Garun looks down and his hands are trembling. When he looks up again, Duncan feels abruptly serious, seeing how he has demolished the man's ego completely with just a few words and a laugh. He recalls the beatitude that the meek will inherit the earth, and is disgusted that a man like Garun would be such a one. Garun earnestly asks whether Duncan will witness their lives and rituals and judge them. And Duncan finally feels a bit of guilt over his behavior here, which, like, is completely out of proportion. Like, he could be upset about this, but his reaction is just so, like, childish. The man has very poor control of his emotions, I have to say.
Yeah, he certainly does.
Like, I know we saw an outburst from, like, the real original Duncan Idaho once, but he was, like, super spice drunk. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of excusable. Like, was the original Duncan this volatile? Or is it just this version of Duncan because of the stress and weirdness of the place that he's in?
I mean, think about the general conditions. I mean, he's a Gola. He's been, you know, he was awakened to his memories, but then thrown into basically an entirely new universe. It's completely different. So he's completely out of place here. He attacked Mineo and couldn't even fight him, an old man, because he's an older model, right? So he
just... Well, he was having outbursts before that, but yeah.
His whole basis for existing before was being the swordmaster of a great house that doesn't really exist anymore at this point, and he can't even be a swordmaster because he couldn't fight anyone here because he's an older model, so...
That's true.
He's basically been uprooted from his reality and thrown somewhere where he's mostly useless, but he's also, like, in a position of power, even though he's useless, right? So, I mean, all of that must be really jarring, and then he goes here, which is, like, a place where he theoretically could actually connect to some part of his past... which I'm assuming he's been desperate to do because there is nothing here. And then he goes here and it's not at all what he would expect it to be.
In a way, he's in a plight very similar to the Museum Fremen in that it's this like remnant of the past that has been either brought back repeatedly or just like kept around all of this time despite increasingly little reason for it to exist solely for Leto's pleasure, apparently.
Yeah.
So there's actually a lot of similar threads between the existence of these two things at all, Duncan and this village. They're both just, like, sacrificial lambs for Leto's ego, I guess.
Yeah.
At any rate, Duncan agrees to teach Garun and his village anything Fremen that he knows. Nayla scowls at him, as this is obviously not part of the plan, and presumably Leto wouldn't be happy about this. But Duncan says that it will help to pass the time, and that it may return something of the true Fremen to this land. Siona basically rolls her eyes and says they don't need to bother with this nonsense, eager to get to their rooms. Nayla apprehensively informs her that she hasn't told her something yet, which Siona assumes means that Nayla has been ordered to keep them here. Nayla points out that there really isn't anywhere for them to go anyway, so she doesn't have to try very hard to keep them here. But the actual thing she hasn't told them yet is that she has been strictly ordered by Leto himself to ensure that Duncan and Siona share quarters again. Which I think no one should be surprised about, given last time.
Mm-hmm.
Siona looks at Duncan and pointedly asks if he remembers her warning in the Citadel, and he snarls back at her that his hands are for him to do what he wishes, but she needn't worry about him having any wish to touch her, so they're both just... Ugh, I hate you.
I half expected Nayla to just be like, and also the God Emperor provided this set of lingerie which you must wear while the two of you are bunked up.
Plot twist, she hands it to Duncan instead of Siona. Oh my god. Yeah, it is kind of just hilarious that Leto's whole plan just seems to be like force them to share a room until they give up and bang. Anyway, Siona nods and turns away, angrily saying that it doesn't matter where they have to sleep in this disgusting place, and she orders Garun to take them to their quarters. Neither she nor Duncan are being very graceful guests to the Museum Fremen, who really haven't done anything to deserve their ire other than just, you know, existing.
Yeah.
Like, Siona's mad that they have to be here at all, and she's mad about being paired up with Duncan. Duncan is mad about being paired up with Siona and at, like, the sad conditions of the current so-called Fremen. But, like, none of this is the Museum Fremen's fault, and they're both just being, like, complete assholes for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
Intriguingly, as Siona turns away, Garun turns his head towards Duncan, hiding his face in his hood so that no one else can see before winking at him. I'm not sure whether this is just because Garun now feels some kind of kinship with Duncan, now that he's going to teach him real Fremen ways, or if he's just making, like, an improper joke about Duncan shacking up with Siona. Like, it's just, like, the wink thing. Like, I don't know what the wink means. Like, the fact that he, like, turns his head and, like, winks at Duncan, like, we're buds now. or like you're gonna get with that chick, or like I don't know what the wink means, but it's very strange.
I think it's just like you're getting laid, dude. I think it's basically what it is. I don't know.
Yeah, it's weird. It was strange. I didn't quite know what it was supposed to mean, so that was weird.
It frankly seems kind of out of place, but whatever.
Yeah, whatever. I guess maybe Garoon's just trying to get on Duncan's good side.
Could be.
But yeah, it was a weird way to end the chapter, certainly. Mm.
Yep, that it was.
All right, shall we go on to our final chapter for the day?
Yes, let's do it. So, to start with our epigraph from the Stolen Journals. What is the most immediate danger to my stewardship? I will tell you, it is a true visionary, a person who has stood in the presence of God with the full knowledge of where he stands. Visionary ecstasy releases energies which are like the energies of sex, uncaring for anything except creation. One act of creation can be much like another. Everything depends upon the vision.
Yeah, I mean, he's basically just saying here that visionaries are the greatest threat to his plans, right?
Mm-hmm. And I guess people who have been close to him and understand his vision or can have a better vision or whatever could potentially be a threat to him, and that's basically it, sort of what I read into it as well.
Or someone like Siona, maybe.
Yeah, well, I mean, she's seen the golden path now, right? Even if she doesn't remember the specifics and sort of has that, like, you know, GPS.
Spidey sense.
Yeah.
Path sense. Worm sense?
But I guess it's relevant to the chapter specifically just because it's talking about, you know, you have Malky here, who is someone who was close to Leto, right? And potentially got somewhat of an understanding of the Golden Path, maybe, just by being in proximity to him and hearing his ramblings. I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, Malky is interesting. Mm-hmm. Shall we dive in and get our first and last encounter with the man?
Yes, let's do it.
Okay, so as we begin the chapter, Leto is in the Little Citadel, looking out from the balcony towards Tuono Village, where Duncan and Siona have been exiled to, becoming stressed at the delays leading up to his marriage to Hui, but also, at the very least, cognizant of the fact that it is entirely his own fault for capriciously changing his mind and making poor Maneo reconfigure his plans at the last minute. So he's like, God damn it, why is this wedding taking so long? Then being like, oh yeah, I did that.
You fucking idiot.
He's such an asshole.
I know, right?
Oh, my God. Maneo, who is here with him at the Little Citadel, is anxious at how the planning will be handled in his absence from the Citadel proper. In the meantime, however, Leto must deal with Malky. Looking out at the horizon and waiting, he becomes so lost in thought that he speaks an ancient verse without realizing it, which prompts Maneo to ask what he means. It's something about a nightingale and a plum tree. And even when Leto repeats and explains the verse, Maneo confesses that he doesn't understand, to which Leto rudely replies, stop mouthing the obvious, Maneo. Which is just, again, he's so mean to Maneo all the time.
So fucking savage.
I don't understand. Seeming pensive, Leto muses that he and Maneo at least provide good theater, as religion so often creates. But of course, Maneo doesn't really get what he means. Does anyone?
Probably not, no.
Leto speaks more verse, and Maneo worriedly notes that Leto is troubled, and the genuine concern in his voice tugs at Leto's heart. Maybe he should feel guilty about being such a dick to Maneo all the time. Darkness falls, aside from this thin sliver of moon above the clouds. Maneo asks why they have come out to this place, as Leto apparently hasn't yet told him, because he wanted to see Maneo's surprise. He now reveals that a guild lighter carrying fish speakers and a certain infamous Malky will soon land near them in the desert. Maneo is surprised, having heard no word of this, and Leto points out that Malky had once tempted Maneo far more than anyone else. Maneo protests that he never accepted any such temptations, and Leto says that he knows this, but the shock of the sudden memories of Malky have made Maneo armed for anything I may require of you. When Maneo asks for clarification, it becomes clear that he means potentially murdering Malky if Leto deems it necessary. Spoiler alert, he does. Maneo does not seem super into this idea, seemingly hoping to deflect this responsibility onto Reverend Mother Antaiak, but unsurprisingly, based on his premonition in the last chapter of Siona's testing, Leto reveals that she is dead. Maneo sheds no tears for the Bene Gesserit, but Leto regrets her death, given her faithful service to him. Upon discovering Leto's interest in Malky and hoping to uncover what secrets he possessed, both the Guild and the Salaxu had made moves to capture him themselves, and Antaiak had given her life holding them off long enough for the fish speakers to move in and take control of the situation. So, she sacrificed her life doing Leto's will, and I think he regrets that it came to that. Minea wonders what secret Malky has that could have prompted such interest by the other factions. Leto reveals that Malky had disappeared for a long time, not dying, but simply vanishing such that even Leto could not see him. Minea was shocked at such an idea, but Leto indicates that he knew about the Ixians' advances in their bubble machine, and was even pleased by its progress. Minea puts the pieces together, with Leto having expressed a wish for a device that could hide his recorded journals. So Minea reasonably thinks that Malky's secret is the Ixian technology itself, but Leto tells him that he has an even more important secret, but one that he doesn't believe Leto even suspects. Minea doesn't see what could be a bigger deal than outside factions having the ability to hide from Leto's sight, but Leto informs him that that technology is really no longer a secret at this point, as the various factions which had descended on Ix have all scattered and taken the information with them. Minea is fearful of the consequences, but Leto doesn't seem worried, like, at all, simply acknowledging that intelligent enemies will be able to use it effectively to leave no tracks. So, this fundamentally changes the nature of Leto's control over his empire. Like, it seems like it would be the beginning of the end. If his empire is controlled by him being able to see and deal with threats, and now all of the important and powerful factions who don't like this control he exerts over him can now hide from him.
Yeah.
It seems like it's going to be a lot more difficult for him to maintain control of the Empire.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Leto then abruptly changes the topic, asking whether Nayla resents reporting to Minea, and what she reports back about the current Duncan. Minea is nonplussed at why Leto has suddenly brought this up, but of course answers dutifully, as he does. It sounds like Nayla is fine with reporting to Minea, as it is what Leto had commanded, and he reports that there have been no attempts at breeding. But Duncan is instead spending his time teaching the Museum Fremen of the old ways from the time of Dune. Leto asks whether Minea has passed on a particular message to Nayla, which Minea acknowledges but is frustrated by the danger inherent in it. Basically, Leto has reinforced Nayla's orders to unquestioningly do whatever Siona asks of her, with some exception that isn't vocalized. Minea knows it's dangerous, as he feels that his daughter is dangerous, and he fears that she is not loyal to the God Emperor. He also seems to have some concern about Nayla herself, but again, doesn't get a chance to vocalize it. So there's like a couple times where like he gets cut off and we don't hear the end of what he's going to say. Minea pleads for Leto to move his wedding away from Tuono, but Leto won't hear of it for unclear reasons. They have a cryptic exchange about the Golden Path, but are interrupted by the arriving airship. Leto sends Minea down on his cart with orders to bring back Malky and only Malky. He also orders Minea to convey his forgiveness to the guild in exchange for the service, though Minea protests, given that they too have stolen the secret Ixian technology. Leto simply says that they serve his purpose, and Minea heads off. A short while later, Minea returns with the bound Malky. Leto notes how much the man has aged, but he can still see the clear resemblance between Malky and Hui, apparently with the same underlying facial structure, save for the masculinizing influence of a lifetime of androgens. Malky's eyes snap open, and Leto is disturbed to see the evil in the eyes that are so like those of his Hui. Malky and Leto banter about the fish speakers, whom presumably Malky had done his share of fooling around with back when he was ambassador, but whom had also roughed him up quite a bit bringing him here, and he calls them hunters. Leto argues that Antaek was the hunter, while the fish speakers were merely the cleanup crew. Minea seems surprised at how flippant Malky is being, but then recalls that this is how he has always been, remembering how dangerous he is. Leto and Malky continue to banter, with Minea feeling excluded, with Malky making obvious condescending comments, Leto kind of echoing that general vibe, and Minea just feeling like he is kind of a third wheel in this reunion between Leto and his old friend, regardless of the less than festive circumstances. Like, Leto and Malky are like cracking jokes at each other, and Minea is just like, alright guys.
I feel like Mineo's such too. A third wheel in this chapter.
He is. Leto basically only brought him out here so that he'd have someone else to murder Malky at the end of the chapter. Like, there's really no other reason for Minea to be here. Minea feels like the two of them are both laughing at him, an inferior and less intelligent creature than the two of them. Throughout this, Malky points out, much like Siona had, that Leto is tricky with words. Leto asks Malky to tell him about Hui, but he doesn't initially reveal anything, instead asking if it's true they are actually going to get married. He then starts to try to make an inappropriate comment, but hurts himself laughing due to his injuries. But then he manages to pull himself together, addressing Leto as Old Worm, which scandalizes Minea, and then asking whether he has a monster penis with which he might terrorize poor Hui. Which is really just not something I needed to have brought up again. Maybe it's realistic that people would be so focused on, like, does Leto have a dick? But I am so over the discussion of Leto's non-existent genitals. It's so annoying. Like, Frank Herbert has spent an inordinate amount of this book on this particular topic.
Yeah, definitely.
Leto points out that he told Malky the truth of the matter years ago, but Malky counters that nobody tells the truth. Leto tries to get Malky to actually tell him about Hui. Malky says that Leto likely already knows all he has to say, but Leto wants to hear it from him anyway. It turns out that the Thalaxu had given the Ixians the information they needed, but the actual plan was executed fully by the Ixians, so the actual, like, production of Hui was not done by the Thalaxu.
Mm-hmm.
Mineo, hearing this, has no idea what's going on and doesn't understand the connection between Hui and the Thalaxu, and he asks for clarification. Mineo and Malky bicker a bit, and Leto tells Mineo to stop tiring out Malky. So yet again, just like, your third wheel, stop talking. Malky seems to try to stir up some trouble, asking whether Leto never wondered why Mineo never tried to take the whole shebang away from you, which leads to a side tangent about what shebang means. Leto tries to get the conversation back on track, bringing the discussion back to Hui. Malky reveals that she was basically cloned from a few of Malky's cells, but turned into his, like, exact opposite. I'm not sure how they accomplished this, unless they have some very advanced chromosomal deletion and duplication technology, or engineered a very specific complete androgen insensitivity syndrome, but something-something future tech, they were able to make her into a girl to be the exact opposite of Malky. But, like, I really just want to point out that it's not like you can just, like, take an embryo and, like, turn it from a boy into a girl. Like, that's just Ixian, not how it works.
It's the Ixian yin-yang technology. That's what I'm going to call it.
They just, like, they cloned Malky and then put the baby in an opposite ray.
Yeah.
Which also very much reinforcing the specific gender binary, but aside from that, it's just, like, a ridiculous concept that you could just invert the gender as well as every other characteristic about them to, like, make a perfect opposite.
Yeah,
it's like an absurd concept.
It's a really fancy Ixian Build-A-Bear workshop.
Anyway, they basically raised Hui to be the complete opposite of Malky, and this all took place within the No Room, as the Ixians very creatively call it.
Yeah, and this this concept of a No Room or something like that will come up again, and it's like weird phrasing. I've never, like, completely been comfortable with it. I understand, like, what the point is. Like, you can't see into it if you have prescience, but it's just weird.
It's just a dumb name. Like, yeah. A no room. It sounds like a child came up with the name.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I would have called it, like, the prescience bubble or, like, I don't know, something better than no room, but whatever. That's what it's called, apparently. So Hui was raised in this no room where Leto can't see. But Leto points out that he could see when Malky had disappeared into the no chamber. Basically, like, he could see the absence of Malky, and he knew that it wasn't because Malky died.
Yep.
Mineo finally puts the pieces together and is predictably horrified at the idea that Hui is basically a female clone of Malky and that she was raised in this Ixian hiding chamber, declaring that he'll call off the wedding immediately, which obviously Leto forbids, having suspected something like this anyway. Malky mocks Mineo. Mineo protests, but Leto admonishes him and he falls silent. Leto reminisces about a time tens of thousands of years ago when I was another person, when he had made a mistake. So he's obviously referring to something out of his ancestral memories because even he is not tens of thousands of years old. His past self had apparently declared that the present and future aren't important, but that the meaning of life can only be found in memory. Malky interjects, calling Leto old worm again, and Mineo physically covers his mouth to shut him up, which I thought was kind of funny. Leto continues, saying that these words had been a foolish lie, merely beautiful words with no truth in them. Memory is not the key to meaning, but spiritual anguish is, apparently. Malky says that he personally sees no point in the anguish inflicted by the fish speakers who had been bringing him in. Leto says that he suffers no anguish, which Malky sarcastically objects to. Like, yes, I am in quite a great degree of anguish, actually. But Leto speaks over him, saying that that's mere physical pain, but it will soon be over. Malky asks when he will know the spiritual anguish of which Leto speaks, and Leto simply says, perhaps later. Leto turns to Mineo and asks if he truly serves the Golden Path, making him promise to repeat none of what he has heard here tonight. Malky continues to mock throughout this exchange. Leto gestures at Malky and tells Mineo he can't bring himself to actually do the deed of killing Malky, or even ask Mineo to do so directly, but comments that Malky must be eliminated anyway. So the old plausible deniability, I didn't actually ask Mineo to kill him routine. Like, this is functionally not different than telling Mineo to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's so stupid. It's such, like, a pansy-like bullshit oh, well, I can't actually ask you to do it, but, like, you're here and it has to be done, so, like, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's so stupid. I hate this. Malky is listening and sneers at Leto's so-called cleverness. Mineo plays his part, saying that maybe if Leto goes down to the end of the room, when he comes back, the problem will be magically solved. Malky continues to sneer in the background. Leto goes down to the end of the chamber and looks out over the balcony, considering that if he fell off the edge here, the fall would likely kill even him. We get an interesting hint that it seems like the Golden Path is contingent on him dying in or near water, presumably because of the sand trout needing to reseed the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't do that without water, maybe? Because Leto knows there's no water in the sand below, and he can feel his Golden Path popping in and out of reality just by thinking about his possible death of falling in a place with no water.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like if he died here, it would be a problem. And that if he dies near water, that's what's supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's not explained why. My best guess is it has something to do about the sand trout, but it seemed clear that, like, dying in a place with no water was bad.
Yep, I think that makes sense.
Malky calls out to him, while Leto can hear his cart rasping along the sand scattered on the floor. Malky calls out again, calling Leto the best, most unsurpassable evil in the whole universe, before Mineo chops him in the throat to shut him up. Intriguingly, Leto reflects on this move that, yes, Mineo knows that one, which makes me wonder what event Leto is recalling in which Mineo had, like, chopped people in the throat. Even as he thinks this, he can hear the balcony shield sliding open, the litter moving along the balcony railing, and then silence as Malky is dropped to the sands below. Mineo will have to go down and bury Malky to dispose of the body, as there are no sandworms to consume his corpse. Leto thinks to himself that he can pray for neither Malky nor Mineo. He thinks that he may be the only religious consciousness because he is truly alone, and therefore cannot pray at all. And that ends the chapter. So, farewell, Malky. We hardly knew ya.
Yeah.
Interesting man.
He was, and this relates to a thought that I sometimes have with these books, and it's especially true with the Brian Herbert adaptations we'll get to in a couple books, but I thought Malky was an interesting character, and he could have been introduced earlier in the story and could have been part of this a bit more, right? I feel like you could have had a setting where maybe Hui is going to be the new ambassador, but Malky is the current ambassador, and, like, you have him engaged earlier on in the story. And I know there was that other ambassador who left, but he could have just been, like, a delegate or something
like
that.
Or you could have had, because he was the old ambassador and he's Hui's uncle, you could have had him, like, bringing her here.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, he could have been, like, mentoring her
or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Because he's an interesting character, and I feel like when you bring him in the room where it's him and Leto, like, there's interesting conversations. Obviously, his effect on Mineo is really interesting. So I feel like you could have had more of that in the story, even if it wasn't all the time. The other thing that I think is bothersome is, like, with Antayak, that she just dies off screen. Like, there was some sort of an event that took place where she died trying to take out Malky, right? That would have been a great chapter to have.
Yeah.
Like, why couldn't that stuff have been part of the plot and you would have been able to actually see it? It really bothers me when Frank Herbert does this thing where there's these events that take place that aren't part of the core plot. They're like a side plot, and you just don't get any of the side plot.
Well,
you just get a reference to it, and
like
that's it.
Like the murder of Paul's first child.
Yeah,
exactly. The first lady, who is never mentioned or, like, remembered
it was,
again.
It was very present. That's a great example. It was very present in the first book, because that's one. Also, Beast Robin dying is a second one, right? You could have seen something happen with that. So I think there's these little things like that that you could have fleshed out a bit more, and it could have been an interesting part of the story. And it would have given you, like, another character to latch onto and wonder, like, oh, where's this character going? What's going to happen to them, right? Which and it's the same thing with Antayak, right? So it would have been a little bit more interesting if you had them in the plot a bit more and more engaged. And maybe Frank Herbert didn't want the book to be longer than it was or anything like that. But I feel like there's existing plot you could have woven a character like Malky into. And it
or even if it would have been too difficult for, like, the main plot and with Hui to have Malky himself present for most of the book. I just feel like you could have had some more, like, flashback of, like, what the interactions between Malky and Leto were. Because we get a lot of references to it, but very little, like, actual specific memories and conversations. So I felt like I didn't have a good handle on what Malky was like.
Mm-hmm.
Besides, like, he was kind of a dick, but Leto liked him anyway.
Yeah.
Which, like, is definitely captured here.
Right.
But yeah, no, I agree. I think it would have been cool to have him introduced earlier, or at least hang around for a few chapters before he's, like, immediately murdered.
Mm-hmm.
So that was unfortunate. Yeah, so not much left in the book. good set of chapters, definitely some plot moving. We're finally getting close to the wedding, which I feel like something is going to happen at the wedding. Like, I feel like there's been a lot of Chekhov's Nayla's laser gun. Like, she's going to be the only one with a laser gun at this ceremony.
Also, and I wonder, is this the same laser gun that the original Duncan at the beginning of the book had tried to assassinate
I'm sure Leto with, or is it a different one? Access to laser guns, I don't know. I'm sure there's more than one laser gun on the planet.
Be interesting if it was the same one.
But, so there's that. She's going to be the one at the wedding with the laser gun. She has been repeatedly ordered to do whatever Siona wants. Siona does not seem at all on board with everything. Definitely still seems like she wants to murder Leto. Like, I feel like there's lots of options for a dramatic wedding assassination attempt at the very least.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess we'll have to see.
Yeah.
Really wonder what Nayla would do in that circumstance.
Right.
And how Duncan figures into all of this. Like, would he help? Because he kind of hates Leto now. Would he be able to bring himself to, like, actually kill, like, the child of the last Atreides he really served?
Mm-hmm.
Even if said child has become a several thousand year old worm creature by now. The whole fucking Fremen village thing, like, I'm still really upset by that. Just, like, the generational subjugation of these people for no purpose other than apparently Leto's amusement is just, like... Like, a lot of the shitty things Leto does, I can understand the justification for. Like, I might not agree with it. I might not definitely see all the justification. But I understand why it's being done. Like, we discussed previously that, like, I don't think you can question that Leto genuinely believes he's doing what he must.
Mm-hmm.
But I just cannot see any possible justification for what he does to these people.
Right.
It's just, like, awful for no reason. Again, other than, like, apparently his amusement or, like, nostalgia. But, like, he also seems to actively despise these people. So, like, why are you doing this to them?
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I don't know. I find it so, like, upsetting for... Just because people doing bad things is always bad. But, like, at least if there's a good reason behind it, you can at least understand why it's being done. But this just seems capricious for no reason at all. I mean, similar to the constant revivals of Duncan. Mostly because Leto wants to have a Duncan, not because of any, like, great need for it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he did also weave him into the breeding program here and there. So, I guess specific DNA reasons for some end goal, but...
Just, like, harvest a bunch of sperm, man. Like, it's not very advanced technology to just, like, freeze sperm. It happens all the time now. I know they don't want to do, like, IVF, but, like, artificial insemination is not that, like...
It would be a boring plot device, though.
I know. But, I mean, it's not even like the Duncan thing is critical, because there was a point at which Leto was, like, considering stopping the Talaxu, and then they just sent him a new one anyway, and he was like, yeah, I guess I'll keep going. But it clearly wasn't critical to the breeding program, if that was the case, so. Anyway. Excited to see what happens in the last couple chapters, though. So we've only got, what, two more episodes, and then our book four wrap-up?
Yeah.
And, about a month from the time we're recording this, at least, although we know it won't be released for a week or so, is going to be the movie.
Yeah. Yep, so on the horizon.
Pretty excited about that, too.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be diving into... I always forget. Is it Chapter House or Heretics next?
Heretics.
Okay. So we'll be diving into Heretics and getting into the movie in the next month or so.
Yep. Exciting times.
Anything else you want to mention about today's chapters?
I don't think so. I think we can wrap up.
Okay.
Till next time, I'm Alex.
I'm Elaine.
Thanks for listening. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Pod Emperor of Dune. If you enjoyed listening to us, we'd appreciate a review on your podcasting host of choice, and be sure to let your friends know about us. You can find us on Twitter under the handle NerdIsayMore, or send us an email at nerdisaymore@gmail.com. If you'd like to support us further, please go to patreon.com/nerdisaymore, where you can also get access to exclusive content.